In April 1867, Bank was ransomed for $333. That night, a heartbroken Tekwashana shut her out of the tent. Later, she relented and convinced Bank to try to escape with her. Tekwashana packed water and meat and carried the girl on her back. This was extreme behavior, punishable by violence, and clear evidence of how much Tekwashana loved her adopted daughter. The two were tracked down and caught the next day. Bank was soon returned to her family. At the reunion, she realized that she had forgotten how to speak English. Another account, less complete but similar in many ways, came from a girl who lived in Central Texas. One of the bloodiest raids ever carried out by Comanches took place in Legion Valley, near modern-day Llano, Texas, in 1868. They took 7 captives, but killed 5 of them in the first few days, including a baby and a 3-year-old, leaving only lovely, long-haired Melinda Ann Minnie Caudle, 8, and a boy named Temple Friend, 7. Minnie was immediately adopted by a fat Comanche woman with whom she rode back to the Indian camp. Her new mother slept with her to keep her warm and tried to shelter her from the events of the first night, when Minnie's 2 aunts were raped and tortured as they wept and prayed aloud. The next day, the captors decided the 2 aunts were too much trouble. When they seized them and killed them, Minnie's Comanche mother threw a blanket over her head so she would not have to watch. Like Bank Babb, Minnie Caudle was treated with great kindness. Her new mother told her stories by the fire. The Comanche women would not let the Indian men harm her. They cooked meat for her the way she liked it, and when they passed salt licks, they made sure to get some salt to season her food. They dressed her in buckskin and greased her body with tallow to keep her dry in rain and snow. Like Bank, too, Minnie was held captive half a year, then ransomed and returned. Her story survived in 1 published interview and in later interviews with her descendants. Thus, 2 experiences that were very likely similar, except for the ransoming and return, to Cynthia Ann Parker's. One can only speculate. As long as both of them lived, Bank and Minnie defended the Comanche tribe. Minnie Caudle would not hear a word against the Indians, according to her great-granddaughter. Her great-grandson said, "She always took up for the Indians. She said they were good people in their way. When they got kicked around, they fought back." This is asserted against the brute facts of her own experience, which involved watching her captors rape and kill 5 members of her family. Bank Babb, against all reason and memory, felt the same way. In 1897, she applied for official adoption into the Comanche tribe. Both girls had seen something in the primitive, low barbarian Comanches that almost no one else had, not even people like Rachel Plummer, with long experience of tribal life. Bank's brother Dot Babb described it as bonds of affection, almost as sacred as family ties. "Their kindnesses to me had been lavish and unvarying, and my friendship and attachment in return were deep and sincere." The children all had the sense that, at the core of these most notorious and brutal killers, there existed a deep and abiding tenderness. Perhaps that should be obvious, since they were, after all, human beings, but it was absolutely not obvious to white settlers on the western frontier in the mid-19th century. In April 1846, an Indian agent from Texas named Leonard H. Williams was dispatched by the U.S. Indian commissioners to find a Comanche headman named Pahayuco. This was not just any Paraibo. Pahayuco was, along with the cunning diminutive Mopachucope, Old Owl, the greatest of the Panataka peace chiefs. In 1843, he had intervened to stop the torture and killing that had been planned for 3 Texas commissioners who had been sent to make amends for the Council House massacre. Most of his tribe had supported the idea of burning the white man. Pahayuco had that sort of power. He was a large, portly man, weighed more than 200 pounds, had several wives, and what one observer described as a pleasing expression of countenance, full of good humor and joviality. His name has been translated as the Amorous Man, but one suspects a more priapic meaning in the Comanche original. Colonel Williams, whose expedition consisted of 11 men, was instructed to invite the chief to treaty talks, the first ever with the United States, of which Texas had just become part. He was also told to find out if there were any captives in the camp and to purchase them if he could. Williams found Pajayuco on the Washita River in what is now Oklahoma, probably not far from where it flows into the Red River, about 75 miles north of modern-day Dallas. It is unclear how Williams found the village in the great wild beyond of the unsurveyed Indian territories, but he undoubtedly used Indian guides who were friendly with Comanches, very likely Delawares or Wichitas. White men rarely found anything anywhere on the Comanche plains without Indian guides. It must have been a heart-pounding, adrenaline-pumping moment when his small band first rode unannounced into the huge Comanche village with its lodges and campfires and racks of drying buffalo meat that snaked for miles along the banks of the river. The arrival of the Williams party created an immediate uproar in the camp. Some of the younger warriors plotted immediately to kill them. Luckily, Williams found out about this from a Mexican boy captive and immediately claimed the protection of Pajayuco, who, according to Williams, with difficulty succeeded in pacifying and restraining his men. Having narrowly escaped assassination, Williams now discovered, to his astonishment, that the Indian village contained the blue-eyed, light-haired Cynthia Ann Parker, the last unaccounted-for victim of the infamous massacre at Parker's Fort, the little blonde girl who had never returned. It is unclear exactly how he learned of this, because she certainly did not tell him, and because being rescued from her grim and horrible fate was entirely the white man's idea and not hers. She was 19. Colonel Williams had met her before, having been acquainted with the Parker family in their early days in Texas. She was also, well, Cynthia Ann Parker. Such was her notoriety, even then, that Williams immediately dispatched a runner with the news back to the governor's office in Austin. Then Williams set about trying to purchase her from the Indians. Buying and selling captives was normal enough commerce in those days. It had been a source of profit to the Comanches since the earliest days of their ascendancy on horseback. They had done a brisk trade in Apache and Mexican captives, often using the elaborately tattooed Wichitas of north-central Texas as brokers. The captives often ended up transshipped like bales of cotton in Louisiana markets. Nowadays, the business seemed to be centered in various Red River depots, where mercenary traders and other louche types from the outer borderlands, with few scruples, ran a sort of human arbitrage business, ransoming captives from the Indians, then reselling them to their families at a profit. A few of them, like Holland Coffee, seemed well-intentioned enough. In any case, there was always a market for captives, Indian or white. It was a highly speculative business and involved a good deal of lying and misrepresentation. There were captives whose saviors turned out to be the worst sort of swindlers. But, as William soon discovered, this case was different. The Indians simply would not negotiate. In one account, he offered 12 mules and 2 mule loads of merchandise for her, a princely sum for a single hostage. That was refused by the Indians, who, according to a newspaper story, say they will die rather than give her up. Another had him offering a large amount of goods and $400 to $500 in cash. Still, the Indians refused. There were several reported versions of Cynthia Ann's behavior. In one, she ran off and hid to avoid Williams and the others. In another, she wept incessantly, presumably at the thought of being returned. In a third version, Colonel Williams was granted permission to speak to her. She approached him, then sat down under a tree and stared in front of her, refusing to speak or even to indicate whether she understood him. In James T. DeShield's 19th century telling, almost certainly embellished for the tender sensibilities of his readers, the anxiety of her mind was betrayed by the perceptible quiver of her lips, showing that she was not insensible to the common feelings of humanity. A letter written 4 months later from Commissioners Pierce Butler and M.G. Lewis to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs in Washington cleared up the mystery. They suggested that the problem was not with Paha Yuko or with the other headmen, who were more than willing to sell her for the right price. It was rather that the young woman is claimed by one of the Comanches as his wife. From the influence of her alleged husband, or from her own inclination, she is unwilling to leave the people with whom she associates. This was love, apparently, as difficult as that was for the white world to swallow. Either way, she wasn't going anywhere for any amount of money. On the mercenary frontier, this was in itself shocking news. At some point, Cynthia Ann and Pita Nakona began living with the Panaticas, though the exact date will never be known. The Comanches responsible for the Parker's Fort raid were allegedly Nakonis, but the evidence for this is sketchy at best, as was the Taibo's general understanding of Indian bands. They may well have been Panaticas, or even Tanawish, a lesser band that camped, hunted, and raided with the Panaticas, or even a combination of bands. One report had Cynthia Ann with the Yamparicas from the distant north, which was almost certainly not true. But the band distinction is important. Based on the available evidence, the band Cynthia Ann was associated with throughout most of the 1840s were Panaticas, Paha Yuko's southern Comanches. That was bad luck. However she landed with them, it meant that she was thrown into the middle of a social and cultural disaster of epic proportions. To use a later historical parallel, it would have been like being adopted into a Jewish family in Berlin in 1932. There was not much future in it. She thus became the helpless victim of huge colliding historical forces utterly beyond her control. It was the worst time in Comanche history. Worse than the days of grubbing about for roots and rodents in the primeval mountain country of Wyoming 300 years before. For all practical purposes, what happened to the Panaticas in the 1840s destroyed them as a coherent social organization. They did not go down quickly, and they did not go down without a fight. In their death throes, they were in some ways more lethal than ever, particularly in their Mexican raids, but they never recovered. Much of what was left of them, starving and demoralized, limped onto a tiny reservation in 1855, despised even by other Comanches. Only 10 years before, such a thing would have been unimaginable. At the moment of the raid on Parker's Fort, the moment when a weeping Lucy Parker placed her terrified daughter on the rear flank of a Comanche Mustang, the Comanches, and the Panaticas in particular, had been at the peak of their historical power and influence. They had defeated the Europeans, cowed the Mexicans, and had so thoroughly mastered the southern plains that they were no longer threatened by other tribes. They had enough enemies to keep them entertained and supplied with a surfeit of horseflesh, but none to really worry about. Their source of food and sustenance, the buffalo, roamed the plains in record numbers and still ranged into every corner of Comancheria. The tribe's low birth rates virtually guaranteed that their nomadic life following buffalo herds was infinitely sustainable. Their world was thus suspended in what seemed to be a perfect equilibrium, a balance of earth and wind and sun and sky that would endure forever. An empire under the bright summer moon. For those who witnessed the change at a very intimate and personal level, including Cynthia Ann and her husband, the speed with which the ideal world was dismantled must have seemed scarcely believable. She herself, the daughter of pioneers who were hammering violently at the age-old Comanche barrier that had defeated all other comers, now adopted into a culture that was beginning to die, was the emblem of the change. Somehow, she and her husband, Pita Nakona, survived the cataclysm. As nomads, they moved constantly. One imagines her on one of these migrations, on horseback, moving slowly across the open grassy plain with hundreds of others, warriors in the vanguard, toward a wide, hazy horizon that would have looked to white men like unalloyed emptiness. There were the long trains of heavily packed mules and horses and the ubiquitous Comanche dogs. There were the horses dragging travois that carried the huge tent poles and piled buffalo hides and scored the earth as they went along, perfectly parallel lines drawn on the prairie, merging and vanishing into the pale blue Texas sky, all trailed by the enormous horse remuda, the source of their wealth. It must have been something to behold. Cynthia Ann lived a hard life. Women did all of the brutally hard work, including most of the work that went into moving camp. They did it from dawn till dark, led brief, difficult lives, and did not complain about it. They did everything except hunt and fight. Her camp locations show just how far she roamed. Paha Yuko's camps were found in 1843 north of the Red River and south of modern-day Lawton, Oklahoma, on Cache Creek. The encampment was on a creek bank on the open prairie and stretched for half a mile. In 1844, he was camped on the salt plains of present-day north-central Oklahoma on the Salt Fork of the Arkansas River, well north of the Washita, where Williams found him in 1846. In 1847, his band was spotted 100 miles north of Austin in rolling, lightly timbered prairie, camped in a village of 150 lodges, and again that same year in a village in the limestone hills and mesas west of Austin. She was identified as being with the Tanawish band in 1847, who often camped with the Panatica, with whom Paha Yuko was often associated, and for all practical purposes after 1845, may have been the same band. Those camps were in far west Texas, on the headwaters of the Red River. Some accounts had her wearing calico born from the sacking of Linville and fleeing with the discomfited Comanches up the Guadalupe and Colorado, suggesting that she had been with Buffalo Hump on his raid. But these things cannot be proved. Such migrations are in keeping with what we know of the Panatica. In the wake of the Council House fight, they had moved their camps north, away from the extreme hostilities of the Lamar regime. In the middle of the decade, after changes in the political climate, they began to drift back southward to their usual ranges. Cynthia Ann went with them. She moved in a 300-mile radius. Wherever she was, it was her bad luck to be with the Comanches, whose villages and hunting grounds were first in line to be jostled by the impatient and grimly determined onrush of white civilization. The Panaticas had borne the brunt of the Mirabeau-Lamar years, 1838 to 1841. They had been defeated at the Council House, at Plum Creek, and on the upper Colorado River. Two of those had been massacres. They had won military engagements, too, to be sure, including the San Saba and Birds Creek fights, and they had won plenty more against militia and ranging companies that were never recorded. But they must have had the sense that they had lost more than they had won, especially to a foe that seemed to have limitless resources, human and financial, at its disposal. Between 1836 and 1840 alone, the Panatica were thought to have lost a quarter of all their fighting men. With such small numbers, it would normally take years to recover from such setbacks, but the Panaticas were already out of time. What was killing them steadily and surely was not the warlike policies of Lamar, as harsh as they were, or even the catastrophic disappearance of game from their eastern ranges. The agent of destruction was the same one that had destroyed the majority of the population of almost every Indian tribe in the Americas, starting with the Aztecs: white man's disease. This was not the first time that horse tribes had been hit by disease. Prior to 1820, it is thought that some 30 epidemics of varying scales moved through the Plains Indians: measles, malaria, whooping cough, and influenza, taking an unknown toll on their numbers. But the Panaticas were hit harder than any other band or tribe on the plains. Their Mexican raiding had brought back smallpox in 1816, along with another horrifying and easily transmitted disease they had never seen before, syphilis. In 1839, smallpox had swept through them again, this time brought by Kiowas from the Mandan Indians on the Missouri River. Thousands had died. They had no defense against this terrifying invisible magic. While the Comanches' abilities to treat simple medical conditions could be fairly sophisticated, they treated toothache successfully with heated tree fungus, filled cavities by stuffing dried mushrooms in the hole. They made laxatives by boiling the cambium layer of the willow tree. They used mechanical tourniquets and even primitive surgery on gunshot wounds. The best they could muster against these marauding spirits were prayers and incantations, magical markings on the body, and purification rites. One example of the latter was the presumed cure for smallpox. The sufferer took a sweat bath and then immersed himself in a cold stream, a treatment that often proved fatal. Then, in 1849, came the most devastating blow of all, cholera. The disease had first appeared on Earth in India's Ganges River Delta in the early 19th century. It broke out in Europe in 1830, crossed the ocean to America in 1832, and spread rapidly from there. It came west on the wagon trains with thousands of 49ers who were traveling to the gold fields of California. They traveled by old trails like the Santa Fe, but they cut new trails too, including a route along the Canadian River, which passed through Oklahoma and Texas, and thus through the very heart of Comanche country. In 1849 alone, 3,000 pioneers traveled that route. They were a dirty, scurvy lot themselves, with hygiene scarcely better than the Indians, gold-crazed hilljacks from the poorer parts of the East and Trans-Appalachia. They carried death with them, they had smallpox too, and spread it in hundreds of Indian villages. Cholera was not subtle. It killed fast and explosively. Its incubation period was from 2 hours to 5 days, which meant that, from the moment of infection, it could and often did kill a healthy adult in a matter of hours. The disease is marked by severe diarrhea and vomiting, followed by leg cramps, extreme dehydration, raging thirst, kidney failure, and death. It was a horrible way to die, and a horrible thing to watch. The disease was transmitted by the ingestion of fecal matter, either directly or in contaminated water or food. Imagine a village of 500 primitive people with poor or non-existent sanitary habits in which several hundred of them have violent, uncontrollable diarrhea. The water sources would soon be infected, and then everything else would be infected too, creating a sort of microbial nightmare. Unable to understand what was causing it, the people had no chance. Because the Numenu viewed illness superstitiously, the sick were often left to die alone, layering one kind of horror on another. Grief-stricken families left their dying mothers or fathers or children to flee to the safety of another village, only to infect them too. The disease ripped through the rest of the plains as well. Half of the entire Kiowa tribe perished. 5 decades later, Kiowas remembered it as the most terrible experience in tribal memory. Half of the southern Cheyennes died. An estimated 2,000 had perished, a number that included entire bands. There was evidence of disease-driven suicide among Kiowas and Arapahos. No one knows how many thousands of Comanches died in the cholera epidemic of 1849. Some of the northern bands, including the Kutsutika, were devastated by it as well. It is believed that half of the Panataka died. That would mean that the band's members dropped from 8,000 to 2,000 in less than 30 years, though no hard estimate is possible. Most of the important camp headmen died in 1849. What started as gradual disintegration now looked like dissolution. Paha Yuko managed to live through it, though he soon withdrew to far northern ranges. The band chose Buffalo Hump to succeed him, but the title lacked any meaning, since from now on the band had no common leader. What was left of them found that the buffalo no longer came south to their ranges, and that much of the other game had disappeared too. They had signed a few treaties, meanwhile, which of course did nothing to protect them. The agreements drew lines that the Indians could not cross, even to hunt, while white men sent surveying parties scurrying westward across those same imaginary lines into Indian lands. By the early 1850s, many of the Panaticas were starving. In the words of one of their chiefs, Katumsah, "Over this vast country, where for centuries our ancestors roamed in undisputed possession, free and happy, what have we left? The game, our main dependence, is killed and driven off, and we are forced into the most sterile and barren portions of it to starve. We see nothing but extermination left before us, and we await the result with stolid indifference. Give us a country we can call our own, where we may bury our people in quiet. We can see this all now, the complete narrative of the honey-eaters, the roots of their power, their long migration south, their wars with Apaches and Mexicans, their rise to dominance on the southern plains, the curse of their proximity to the settlements, and what the cholera did to them. We can see their degradation, their decay, their suffering, the arc of their fall. But that is all hindsight. No one on the frontier, or in Houston, or in Washington, understood any of this at the time. There was little doubt that the Texans had won the fights at Council House and Plum Creek in the Colorado. But no one knew exactly what that meant, or what portion of the Comanche tribe had been involved. A fierce and independent group, numbering in the thousands, with a remuda of 15,000 horses, and camping in Palo Duro Canyon, the Quahadis, was beyond anything they knew or could guess at. Nor did the Texans have any idea how many Comanches died from cholera or from the smallpox in 1839. They were invisible catastrophes. They would not be fully understood for decades. Comancheria still loomed before them, as dark, impenetrable, and lethal as ever. The last thing on anyone's mind was mounting a large force of soldiers to ride far into the northwest and try to conquer it. The Taibos knew that much, anyway. In this shadowy world of half-knowledge and vague assessments, it was also impossible to see the principal side effect of Lamar's war policy. Though he had driven the southern Comanches north of the Red River and thus produced a temporary peace, he had not changed the nature of the Comanches. The culture was based on war. Young men still had to fight and kill and return with horses. Instead of riding for the Texas frontier, which was now seen as a dangerous place, the Panatica looped to the west, down the old Comanche trace, which opened into the Mexican states of Tamaulipas, Coahuila, Nuevo León, and Chihuahua. There was little effective government here, the legacy of the long, slow decline of Spanish imperial power, and Mexico's lack of will to hunt down marauding Indians in its northern provinces. The 80,000-man army stayed in the south and was mainly used against the Mexican people. The only real threat were the armed vaqueros. The result was a sort of raider's paradise. And now Buffalo Hump and Santa Anna and other Panatica chiefs cut a wide arc of bloody terror through the eastern provinces of Mexico. They left a long trail of bloated and charred corpses and burned-out villages. They tortured hundreds or thousands to death. No one would ever know how many. They took captive children by the dozen, and cattle and horses, and in the summer months, people reported seeing this remarkable procession heading back north along the trace, through current Fort Stockton, a long dusty line of cattle and horses and captives, the spoils of a season's raiding. Comanche raiders killed thousands more people south of the Rio Grande than they ever killed in Texas. Much of this was done by Panaticas, and much of it was done in what history now sees as their dying days. Peace in Texas was an illusion, too. How deeply the whites misunderstood the Comanches was evident in the Peace Treaty of 1844, the product of 3 years' work by Sam Houston, who had returned to the presidency in 1841, bringing his pacifist notions back with him. Though the Texans were dealing with only a fraction of the Panatica, the treaty's signers were only Old Owl and Buffalo Hump, Paja Yuko and Santa Anna were not there, they persisted in referring to the Comanche tribe and the Comanche nation as though all of the bands had been part of the negotiations. Sam Houston himself, old Indian hand that he was, persisted in the mistaken belief that chiefs like Old Owl and Paja Yuko wielded power over other Comanches and Kiowas. In this formulation, they could thus sign a treaty that all Comanches from eastern Colorado and western Kansas to the Mexican border would dutifully obey. The idea was preposterous. The camp headmen within the Panatica band were barely able to agree among themselves. The dangerous Comanches, The Comanches still riding free and unbeaten and unencumbered on the more remote prairies, as yet undestroyed by war or disease, hadn't signed anything. But no one in Texas in the middle century could have told you that, nor could they have imagined that getting rid of the Comanches was going to take another 30 years of war. Colonel Williams's visit to the Comanche camp put the Parker family back in the headlines, as much for the discovery that Cynthia Ann's bones were not bleaching in an alkali creek somewhere as for her refusal to return. On June 1, 1846, the Houston Telegraph and Texas Register ran a story about the meeting. "Miss Parker has married an Indian chief," it said, with the matter-of-factness of a social notice, "and is so wedded to the Indian mode of life that she is unwilling to return to her white kindred." The story added that every possible effort had been made to reclaim her, but they had all been unsuccessful. "Even if she should be restored to her kindred here," the story concluded ruefully, "she would probably take advantage of the first opportunity and flee away to the wilds of northern Texas." Not everyone was willing to accept this state of affairs. Robert Neighbors, a talented Indian agent, who was Texas Commissioner of Indian Affairs at the time, was foremost among them. Believing that Cynthia Ann was the only white captive still alive among the Plains tribes, he mounted a concerted effort in the summer of 1847 to get her back. That meant sending messengers to the villages, bearing gifts and money. He had no more luck than Colonel Williams had. "I have used all means in my power during the last summer to induce those Indians to bring her in by offering large rewards," he wrote in a November 18, 1847 report to the U.S. Commissioner of Indian Affairs, "but I am assured by the friendly Comanche chiefs that I would have to use force to induce the party that has her to give her up." He also said something interesting. He noted that she was with the Tenawish band of Comanches, with whom we hold little or no intercourse. They reside on the headwaters of the Red River. If he was right, and he very likely was, then Cynthia Ann and her husband had jumped bands, and in so doing had traveled well west of the normal Panatica ranges. Paha Yuko himself was sometimes affiliated with the Tenawish, which might explain the jump. Whatever the cause, it was a clear move away from trouble, away from the death throes of the Panaticas. Cynthia and Peta were fleeing the Texas frontier. They were refugees. Within a year, the couple changed bands again. They camped even farther north on Elk Creek, south of the Wichita Mountains in Indian Territory, Oklahoma. There, with the world crashing down around the southern Comanches, a son was born to Cynthia Ann and Peta Nakona. According to later interviews with his descendants, they named him Quinai, Eagle. If that is true, then the name Quana is a nickname. Its meaning, too, is far from clear. According to his son Baldwin Parker in a later interview, the name comes from the Comanche Quina, meaning fragrant, though this name is usually translated as smell, odor, fragrance, or perfume. The Shoshone root word Quanaru, meaning stinking, may suggest the real source of the name. In this theory, people modified his original name to mean stink. Within the next 2 years, Cynthia Ann gave birth to a second son, whom she named Peanuts. From later interviews with Quana, the name originated in his mother's fond childhood memory of eating peanuts around the fireside at Parker's Fort. Both names are unusual and suggest that Cynthia Ann, whom family legend said was a spirited squaw, and her husband, had defied Comanche custom by naming the children themselves. The first anyone knew of these events was in 1851, when a group of traders led by a man named Victor Rose, who would later write histories of the era, saw her in a Comanche village. When they asked her if she wanted to leave, she shook her head and pointed to her children, saying, "I am happily married. I love my husband, who is good and kind, and my little ones, who, too, are his, and I cannot forsake them." Rose described Peta as a great, greasy, lazy buck. The account has an odd ring to it. Rose undoubtedly saw Cynthia Ann because he was the first to report the existence of children. But it is unlikely that she uttered those grammatically perfect sentences. The timing is worth noting. The existence of the two brothers playing at her feet would seem to confirm that Quanah was born before 1850 and possibly as early as 1848. In any case, she was sincere. She was not da now, someone found, the name given to her by Pita Nakona, whose name means he who travels alone and returns. The last anyone on the frontier heard of Cynthia Ann in the 1850s came in a report from the intrepid explorer Captain Randolph Marcy, a reliable chronicler of the frontier. There is at this time a white woman among the Middle Comanches who, with her brother, was captured while they were young children from their father's house in the western part of Texas, he wrote, confirming that she had changed bands and placing her with the Nokonis or the Kotsotikas, who were known as Middle Comanches. This woman has adopted all the habits and peculiarities of the Comanches, has an Indian husband and children, and cannot be persuaded to leave them. For the moment, she was free again in the way that Comanches had always been free, in the way that the hapless Penatica no longer were. She was on the open plains, where the buffalo still roamed in their millions, and Comanche power stood inviolate, where the white man still did not dare to go. 9. Chasing the Wind. The rest of the Parker hostages, Rachel Plummer, Elizabeth Kellogg, John Richard Parker, and James Pratt Plummer, suffered very different fates. All were intertwined in some way with Rachel's father and Cynthia Ann's uncle, James W. Parker, the man whose breathtaking lack of judgment had been largely to blame for the disaster that had befallen the clan in May of 1836. Like many other members of the Parker clan, James was a colorful figure, but he was much more than that. He was one of the most outrageous, extreme, obsessive, ambitious, violent, dishonest, morally compromised, reckless, and daring characters ever to stake a claim on the early Texas frontier. He was a man of more contradictions than anyone could keep track of, a prominent citizen who was accused at various times of being a murderer, counterfeiter, liar, drunk, horse thief, and robber. And yet during his lifetime, he was an elected justice of the peace, one of the original Texas Rangers, a representative at the legendary consultation that set the stage for the Texas Revolution, and a friend of Sam Houston and Mirabeau Lamar. He was a preacher who once had his own church, a successful businessman who owned a sawmill and thousands of acres of land. Though an odor of impropriety, untruth, and general malfeasance haunts his life, he was never convicted of anything. Some of his neighbors believed that the raid itself had been the result of his shady business dealings. They alleged that he had bought stolen horses from Indians with counterfeit money, and that the true purpose of the attack had been to avenge the fraud. Nothing was ever proven, and James himself mounted a spirited defense of his honor in a self-published pamphlet. He admitted to killing 5 people, but they were all Indians, and there were no criminal penalties for murdering redskins in the Republic of Texas. And yet that was not how James Parker was mainly known. For all of the obloquy and misadventure, he was famous throughout the West as the man who searched for the Parker captives. The man who refused to give up. He made 5 trips alone into Indian lands between 1836 and 1837, mostly acting on tips about young white women, like his daughter Rachel, who had been carried off by Indians. He made another 4 or 5 excursions from 1841 to 1844, based on information he believed would lead him to his niece Cynthia Ann Parker, his nephew John Richard Parker, or his grandson James Pratt Plummer. He logged perhaps 5,000 miles, much of it alone. The only remotely comparable captive hunter in American history was a former slave named Britt Johnson, who made 5 trips into the wilderness starting in 1864, searching for his wife and children, who were also captured by Comanches. If James's story begins to sound familiar, it was the basis for John Ford's magnificent western The Searchers, starring John Wayne in the James Parker role, and Natalie Wood as his niece, the screen version of Cynthia Ann. Parker's first trip in search of his relatives, to Nacogdoches in East Texas, was a stunning and unexpected success. His sister-in-law, Elizabeth Kellogg, had been purchased by Delaware Indians and brought into that city to trade. The Delawares, presumably marking up what they had paid the Quiches, who got her from the Comanches, wanted $150 for her. James was both overjoyed and, as would be the case at various times in his life, penniless. He somehow managed to convince his old friend Sam Houston to put up the money. Thus was Elizabeth ransomed on August 20, 1836, 3 months after the raid. History does not record what happened to her after that, though the social position of returned female captives in 19th-century America was deeply compromised. People were under no illusions about what had happened to them. They knew with great specificity what Plains Indians did to adult women, and thus repatriated captives were usually objects of pity. If they were married, their husbands often would not take them back. In several cases, unmarried women captives were wealthy enough to attract husbands in spite of what had happened to them. Elizabeth probably lived out a life of quiet shame in the shadows, perhaps in the home of a Parker relative. She would have been an embarrassment. That may be why James says so little about her. Between August 1836 and October 1837, Parker spent most of his time in the wilderness searching for the captives. He was mainly tracking his daughter Rachel, because in those early years, his informants, traders along the Red River, Texas's northern boundary, had only heard stories of young women and nothing about children being held by Indian tribes. His journeys are chronicles of hardship and near disaster. On his first trip, he found his horse could not swim across the swollen Red River, so he abandoned it, crossed the river on his own, and headed off into the Indian territories on foot, an action that people of the day considered tantamount to suicide. He weathered a driving rainstorm that flooded the prairie to a depth of 2 feet and was followed by a blue norther that howled down out of the Canadian plains and froze it all. He was almost certainly going to die, in his own estimation, when he managed to start a fire by stuffing some cotton from his shirt into his pistol and firing it at a log that had somehow stayed dry in the torrent. On his next trip, he ventured into the wilderness unarmed, again tantamount to suicide, and this time went 6 days without food, breaking his fast by strangling and eating a skunk. On the next, he spent a full month lurking around a Comanche camp, leaving messages in English by nearby streams. He knew that Indians forced captives to fetch water, and was hoping, though there would seem to be less than a chance in a million of this ever happening, to get his daughter's attention. All his suffering was in vain. None of the stories he heard got him any closer to his daughter. In October 1837, he returned home for the fourth time, discouraged and in poor health. While he recuperated, he dispatched his son-in-law Lorenzo Nixon, who was married to Rachel's sister, to the Red River trading posts to see if there was any news of women captives. Now, finally, his luck turned. At one of the posts, Nixon was tipped that a Mrs. Plummer had arrived in Independence, Missouri, outside of modern-day Kansas City. He found her there a few weeks later. Her first words to him were, "Are my husband and father alive?" Nixon said they were. Then she asked, "Are mother and the children alive?" The answer to that was yes, too. Like everything else that happened to the Parker family in those early days, the story of Rachel Parker Plummer's return is a strange and epic tale that stretches across several thousand miles of frontier. She was purchased from her Comanche captor in August of 1837 by a group of Comancheros. At the time, she was probably somewhere on the high plains of eastern Colorado. She was put on a horse and taken on what she described as a very hard 17-day ride to Santa Fe, which was then still a part of Mexico. The Comancheros, who would actually not acquire that name for another 5 or 6 years, were one of the West's most interesting subcultures. They owed their existence to the 1786 peace made by New Mexico Governor Juan Bautista de Anza and the Comanches after his defeat of Cuerno Verde in Colorado. From that year forward, Comanches could freely enter Spanish settlements to trade for horses, and New Mexican traders could operate safely on the plains of Comancheria. American accounts often described Comancheros as renegades or half-breeds, the latter referring to what was supposed to be Comanche blood. In fact, they were half-breeds, or mixed blood, but so was almost the entire population of New Mexico. They were mestizos, of mixed Spanish and Indian blood, as most Mexicans are today. They were less renegades than businessmen, though they were famously hard-bitten characters and occasionally rode with Comanches and Kiowas on horse and cattle-stealing raids. The Comanches traded livestock, hides, and captives to the Comancheros in exchange for beads, knives, paint, tobacco, pots and pans, calico and other cloths, metal spikes for making arrows, coffee, flour, and bread. The trading took place in specific locations, such as Palo Duro Canyon in the Texas Panhandle and various places in northeastern New Mexico. As years went by, more and more of the Comanchero trade was in guns, ammunition, and whiskey, and they dealt increasingly in stolen cattle, which they fenced to merchants who in many cases sold them back to their original owners, often the military. They were important to the Comanches for many reasons, but perhaps the most important was that they allowed the still wild bands, the Cuajades, Yamparicas, Nokonis, and Cotzoticas, to stay out of the white man's settlements, away from the blandishments of white civilization, away from the diseases that were destroying their southern brethren. On the east, a comparable trading network evolved among the Kickapoos, Delawares, and Shawnees in the Indian country, offering the Comanches the same opportunities. Comancheros also gave the people a way to trade and profit from captives. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, the Comancheros had dealt mainly in captive Indians from a variety of tribes for use as mine workers or servants. But starting in 1821, the Anglo settlement in Texas changed all that. Once it became clear that Texans would pay generously for captives, an active market sprang up. When U.S. General Zachary Taylor announced in 1842 that the U.S. government would pay for any captives brought into Fort Gibson in what is present-day eastern Oklahoma, the market went wild, as did the takings. The Comancheros were soon doing a brisk business in white captives as well. The men who ransomed Rachel Plummer were not speculators. They had been operating under specific instructions from William and Mary Donahoe, a wealthy Santa Fe couple who had told them to pay any price for white women. The Donahoes were remarkable people, especially Mary. She was thought to be the first woman ever to travel the Santa Fe Trail, doing so in 1833. She was the first female U.S. citizen to live in Santa Fe. Two of her children were the first Anglo children born there. They took Rachel in and put her up at the best hotel in town, which had dirt floors, where she enjoyed her first night in a bed in 15 months. The Donahoes were exceptionally kind to her, assuring her that everything would be done to return her to her relatives. The people of Santa Fe welcomed her too, in spite of her deeply compromised status. They raised $150 for her to help her get back home. But Rachel's run of bad luck was not quite over. Her $150 was immediately stolen by the dishonest clergyman who had been entrusted to hold it. And then, as she rested in her hotel room, a violent rebellion broke out in the streets of Santa Fe. 2,000 Pueblo Indians ambushed 200 government militiamen. A massacre followed. The rebels beheaded the governor, placed his head on a pole, and paraded it through the streets. They put a district judge in stocks, cut his hands off, and waved them in his face. The Pueblos installed their own governor. This was enough for the Donahoes, who were now fearful for their own safety. They fled east, with the hapless Rachel in tow, back to their Missouri home, a two-month journey of some 800 miles, straight through the heart of Comancheria. In her memoir, Rachel dismisses the trip, which very few white Americans had made at that point, as a minor inconvenience. The road led through a vast region of prairie, which is nearly 1,000 miles across. This, to many, would have been a considerable undertaking, as it was all the way through an Indian country. But we arrived safely at Independence, where I received many signal favors from many of the inhabitants. Reunited with her brother-in-law, Together they departed, in the dead of winter, for Texas. The trip was long, cold, and miserable, yet another 1,000 miles. On February 19, 1838, Rachel arrived at her father's home near Huntsville, Texas, north of Houston. She had made a nearly unbelievable 19-month odyssey across a huge portion of the continent, and it had taken a fearful toll on her. James describes her as being in very bad health and observes, "She presented a most pitiable appearance. Her emaciated body was covered with scars, the evidences of the savage barbarity to which she had been subject during her captivity." Curiously, he says nothing about her life back home. Instead, he describes a protracted illness during which she prayed for her son, James Pratt, and then her peaceful death. She often said that this life had no charms for her, and that her only wish was that she might live to see her son restored to his friends. In about a year from the time she returned to her paternal home, she calmly breathed out her spirit to him who gave it, and her friends committed her body to the silent grave. This strangely bowdlerized account leaves out most of the important events of the last part of her life. James does not mention Rachel's pregnancy, for example, which was in itself a remarkable event. Her third child was conceived soon after she had returned, which meant that her husband, L.T.M. Plummer, had gotten over what so many others could not, the fact of her violation by Indians. They were starting another family. Nor does James mention another remarkable fact. Towards the end of Rachel's pregnancy, his family was forced to flee their home because it was threatened by a gang of vigilantes who had vowed to kill him. The vigilantes believed that he had murdered a Mrs. Taylor and her daughter, apparently in connection with a robbery. According to a letter James sent to Governor Lamar requesting relief, the same gang had staged mock trials and had hanged people. They had written James a note saying they were going to kill him and LTM and destroy their property. James went into hiding and insisted that his family, which numbered perhaps a dozen people, travel to Houston, some 70 miles away. Fearing that the vigilantes might try to kill them, too, they avoided the dirt road and instead made their way, in freezing rain and bitter cold, through thick brush and pine forest, often cutting their own trails. It probably took them a week. They slept out in the open, with only the clothing they had hurriedly gathered before leaving. Rachel was very likely 9 months pregnant at the time. James does not mention this episode in his published narrative. He merely says that Rachel died of a protracted illness, and most historians have tended to let it go at that. But what killed her was the flight from Huntsville to Houston. In a letter he wrote to his friend Mirabeau Lamar on or about the date of Rachel's death, James gave the fullest explanation of what happened. "I directed my family to move to the city of Houston, while at their urgent solicitation, I was induced to keep out of the way of those outlaws. But with such malignant vigilance did these usurpers of the law watch us, that my family, to evade them, was so exposed to the cold rain and inclemency of the weather as not only to endanger all their lives, but has actually taken 4 of my beloved to their long home, among whom was my daughter, Mrs. Plummer." Rachel died on March 19th. Her infant son, Wilson P. Plummer, born on January 4, 1839, outlived her by 2 days. It is ironic that, after all she had suffered and the thousands of miles she had traveled, her death was caused indirectly by her own father in what ought to have been the safety of her own home. In 1841, James started searching again, now focused on the captives still at large, his niece Cynthia Ann, his nephew John, and his grandson James. His account of the next 4 years is again full of derring do and near calamity. In late 1842, he heard that 2 boys had been brought into Fort Gibson. He arrived there in January 1843 to find his grandson and his nephew. James Pratt Plummer was now 8. John Richard Parker was 13. They spoke no English. James's first reaction was to run away, and he had to be persuaded to come back. The three somehow made their way back home, in cold and wet weather, partly on foot, and without proper winter gear. Nothing was ever easy with James, through the Indian Territory and back to Texas. In his narrative, James suggests a simple happy ending for the boys, but it was more complicated than that. John seems to have been returned to his mother, Lucy, who had remarried in 1840 and divorced soon afterward, and who had been mired in the settlement of her dead husband Silas Parker's estate for 4 years. John was dispatched by her sometime around 1850 or 1851, Lucy died in 1852, to try to find Cynthia Ann and bring her back. Somehow he managed to find her, an astounding story in its own right, though he had no more luck than Colonel Williams, Robert Neighbors, or Victor Rose. In his report on his expedition to the headwaters of the Red River in 1852, Captain Randolph Marcy wrote that he had met John Parker around this time and spoken with him. The brother of the woman, who had been ransomed by a trader and brought home to his relatives, was sent back by his mother for the purpose of endeavoring to prevail upon his sister to leave the Indians and return to her family. But he stated to me that on his arrival, she refused to listen to the proposition, saying that her husband, children, and all that she held most dear were with the Indians, and there she should remain. No one knows what happened to John. There were many stories. Cynthia Ann believed, as she later told interviewers, that he had died of smallpox. She was wrong, at least on the timing of his death. He was reported to have served in the Civil War, working for a colonel in the Texas Rifles. The most popular story was that John returned to live with the Comanches. In this version, he came down with smallpox, was abandoned, and nursed back to health by a Mexican woman who had been a captive herself, the night-eyed Aztec Beauty. He became a rancher in Mexico, lived to a ripe old age, and died in 1915. Several newspaper accounts of the day suggested as much. Such are legends of the West. James Pratt Plummer had a more prosaic fate. By the time of his capture, his father, LTM, had remarried and had 2 children. When they arrived back in Texas, the elder James did something that was both bizarre and fully in keeping with his mercurial character. He refused to let LTM have James Pratt. The reasons are not entirely clear, but were most likely financial. James wanted money. He claimed at one point that he paid $1,000 for the 2 children, an apparent lie for which he was later banished from his church. He tried to hold LTM up for some of that. He may have been trying to simply keep his grandson, who looked disarmingly like his beloved daughter Rachel. Unable to gain custody of his son, LTM Plummer petitioned Sam Houston, who was again president of the Republic of Texas. Houston responded angrily, "Sir, your communication in reference to the detention of your son by Mr. James W. Parker came duly to hand. In case of this kind, the attempt to swindle a distressed father on account of his long-lost child is in every way deserving of the severest reprehension. Though I had some reason to suspect the professions of Mr. Parker, yet until this case was presented, I had not supposed him capable of practicing such scandalous fraud upon his kindred and connections. His pretensions about his liability for $200, etc., are utterly groundless. You will, therefore, take your child home." Little more is known of James Pratt's life. He married twice, fathered 4 children, and died on November 17, 1862, of pneumonia while serving in the Confederate Army in Little Rock, Arkansas. James Parker's last trip in search of Cynthia Ann took place in 1844. He presumably learned of Colonel Williams's meeting with her and gave up. He was kicked out of another church, this time for drunkenness. He prospered. He was elected Justice of the Peace in Houston County. He died in 1864 at the age of 67, having outlived most of his children and siblings. By then, the Parkers were one of the most affluent and influential clans in Texas. His brother Daniel had founded 9 churches before his death in 1845, making him the leading Protestant clergyman in Texas. His brother Isaac was a prominent politician an original member of the Texas Congress in 1836. He later served as a state representative and a state senator. Yet another brother, Joseph Allen, was a large landowner and prominent citizen in Houston. For all of their prosperity and success, they never returned to Parker's Fort, which soon disappeared. Some said it was dismantled within a few years, its stout cedar posts used to build other homesteads farther to the east, where life was less dangerous. 10. Death's Innocent Face. Few historians would argue that the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which a defeated Mexican republic signed on February 2, 1848, in the wake of a lopsided war, was as momentous an event in American history as the signing, 17 years later, of the surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, yet in its own way, it was quite as definitive. Appomattox stitched the nation back together. It asserted that this oddball disaggregation of warring states was in fact a single nation with eternal common interests, a unified political idea that now included both a federal government with powers the founders could never have imagined, as well as millions of freed slaves whose welfare and freedom were now its assumed burden and responsibility. But Guadalupe Hidalgo created the physical nation itself. Before the treaty, the American West consisted of the old Louisiana Purchase lands that rose in ladder-like fashion from the mouth of the Mississippi, climbed the courses of the Missouri, and touched the rocky, fog-shrouded shores of the Northwest. It was a tentative, partial fulfillment of the national myth. Guadalupe Hidalgo, in which Mexico gave up its claims north of the Rio Grande, made the dream suddenly and completely real. It added the old Spanish lands that lay, enormous and sun-drenched, athwart the Southwest. They included the modern states of Arizona, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, California, and Nevada. There was Texas, too, in a sense, though it had been subsumed in 1845. U.S. annexation of Texas was what the war against Mexico was about, and the American victory settled the question forever. In all, the United States of America acquired 1.2 million square miles of real estate, an instant 66% increase in its total land mass. In terms of land gained on a percentage basis, it was as though France had acquired Germany. Thus was the nation entirely recast. Its singularity of purpose, its raw and conquistador-like desire to possess and dominate all lands it touched, and to dispossess or destroy all of its aboriginal peoples, its burgeoning will to power, could now stretch untrammeled from sea to shining sea. It was manifest destiny made manifest. The treaty changed everything in the West. It changed the world beyond the 98th meridian for everyone and for all time, but perhaps most radically for the native peoples who inhabited the stark, open middle of the continent. At the time of the Mexican War, this was still mysterious, dangerous, untraveled land. Much of it, from Canada to South Texas, had never been explored by white men, especially the headwaters of the big rivers that ran through the heart of Comancheria. It was pierced in two places, the Oregon Trail, which started in Missouri and scaled the continent along the North and South Platte Rivers to reach the Columbia, and the Santa Fe Trail, starting in the same place, but then snaked from western Missouri to New Mexico, hugging the Arkansas River part of the way. But these were merely highways down which relatively small numbers of pioneers traveled. They did not draw settlement. Westering pioneers did not stop in the middle of the Oregon Trail and decide they wanted to build a cabin. That was never their purpose, and would have been suicidal anyway. The higher plains, including the 240,000 square miles of Comancheria, remained inviolate, their buffalo herds, horse tribes, trade routes, and rough boundaries still intact. The problem for the Comanches was that where once they existed as a buffer between two huge land empires, they now stood directly in the way of American nationhood. They were now surrounded by a single political entity. With the annexation of Texas, They were no longer dealing with a quirky, provincial republic with few resources, devalued currency, and patchwork citizen soldiery. They were now a principal concern of the federal government, with its visions, blue-coated armies, vaults full of tax money, and complex, usually misguided, politically charged Indian policies. In the immediate aftermath of the Mexican War, none of this would have been apparent. In fact, a weird status quo reigned. Until the late 1840s, Texas was still the only part of civilized America that was in range of the horse tribes. In the Indian Territory, the relocations of eastern tribes had played out, depositing some 20,000 Indians from a dozen tribes across modern-day Oklahoma. They jostled with each other and with plains tribes, but not with white men. Not yet. On the northern plains, in Sioux, Arapaho, and Cheyenne country, Indians had dealings with the military and occasionally confrontations, but there were no human frontiers in those lands. The status quo would not hold much longer. In the 1830s and 1840s, white civilization had shouldered its way slowly up the Colorado, Guadalupe, Trinity, and Brazos rivers in Texas, moving inexorably into the Comanche borderlands. Soon those settlements would be replicated in the north, too, ascending the Kansas, Republican, and Smoky Hill rivers, directly onto Cheyenne hunting grounds. It was even moving into the Indian territories, which the federal government had specifically set aside for Indians. In 1849, the floodgates opened. The gold rush was the first great exercise of America's new spatial freedom. People poured giddily into the West in numbers that would have been unthinkable just a year before. But pilgrims, land grabbers, sodbusters, 49ers, and a nation with galloping expansionist urges were not the only problems for the Comanche Nation in those years. Something else had happened during the years of the Texas Republic to change the fundamental nature of their relationship with the white man. Comanche power had long resided in sheer military superiority, the ability, man for man, to outride and outshoot the Anglo-Europeans. This had been true from the earliest days of Spanish rule. Now, for the first time, came a serious challenge. It came in the form of dirty, bearded, violent, and undisciplined men wearing buckskins, serapes, coonskin caps, sombreros, and other odd bits of clothing who belonged to no army, wore no insignias or uniforms, made cold camps on the prairie, and were only intermittently paid. They owed their existence to the Comanche threat. Their methods, copied closely from the Comanches, would change frontier warfare in North America. They were called by many different names, including spies and mounted volunteers and gunmen and mounted gunmen. It was not until the middle of the 1840s that they finally had a name everybody could agree on: Rangers. To understand who they were and why they were necessary, it is important to grasp the extremely difficult, nearly untenable situation in which the new Republic of Texas found itself in the late 1830s. Texas was an accidental nation. It was never supposed to be its own sovereign country. After their victory at San Jacinto, the vast majority of Texans believed that their territory would be immediately annexed by the United States. There were a few would-be empire builders, like Mirabeau Lamar and James Parker, who volunteered to fulfill Lamar's grandiose vision by conquering New Mexico, who had other ideas. But mostly everyone else wanted statehood. They were soon disappointed. There were two main reasons it did not happen. First, Mexico had never recognized the independence of its renegade northern province. If the United States added Texas, it risked war with Mexico, something that in 1836 it was not prepared to do. Second, like other southern states, Texas had a slave economy, and its entry into the United States was strongly opposed by anti-slavery factions. Texas was thus left alone, broke and militarily punchless, for 10 years to confront two implacable enemies, Mexico on the south and the Comanche Nation on the west and north. The fledgling country, would never know peace. Mexican incursions persisted. The city of San Antonio was captured twice by large Mexican armies in 1842. Raids were constant, as was the predation of itinerant bandits and other unsavories from across the border. And Texas's western frontier was the scene of continuous attacks by Comanches. It is interesting to note Texas's peculiar position here. Neither of these enemies would have accepted peace on the terms it would have offered them. Even more remarkably, neither would accept surrender. The Mexican army consistently gave no quarter, most famously at the Alamo. All Texan combatants were summarily shot. The Nimeneux, meanwhile, did not even have a word for surrender. In plains warfare, there was never any such thing. It was always a fight to the death. In this sense, the Texans did not have the usual range of diplomatic options. They had to fight. But while the Mexicans hovered, sent war parties north of the Nueces, and waited for their chance to reclaim their lost province, the constant, lethal, and unstoppable threat still came from the Comanches, who killed thousands more Texans than the Mexicans ever did. As ornery, stubborn, and fearless as the Texans were, they found themselves completely unprepared and ill-equipped to deal with Comanches. So much so that in the early days of the Republic, it looked very much as though the Texans were doomed to suffer the same fate as the Spanish and Mexicans. That was mainly because in the first phase of the Comanche Wars, the Indians held all the advantages. Their superiority started with weaponry. When the Texans arrived from Tennessee, Alabama, and other points east, they brought with them their main firearm, the Kentucky rifle. It was, in many ways, a fine piece of technology. Long, heavy-barreled, short-stocked, and extremely accurate, it could be devastatingly effective when fired from cover by a shooter at rest. It was an excellent hunting rifle, but it was ill-suited to combat, and especially ill-suited to mounted combat. It required a good deal of time to load. Powder had to be measured and poured, and the ball had to be rammed down the barrel with a long rod. Then the tube had to be primed and the flint properly adjusted so that it would strike. This all took at least a minute, which amounted to a death sentence against mobile, bow-wielding Comanches. Worse still for anyone fighting Comanches, the shooter had to dismount to use the long rifle. From the saddle, the weapon lost its only real advantage, which was its accuracy. The Texans had pistols, too, old-fashioned, single-shot dueling weapons, equally cumbersome to load and fire, and equally impractical in the saddle. All of which meant that Texans, in the early days of the Republic, usually fought on foot. From that position, facing a furious mounted attack by a foe who could loose an arrow every few seconds, they had exactly 3 shots, and 2 of those had to be made at close range. They then either had to be covered by their comrades' fire or take their chances reloading. The old Indian trick and the classic wagon train tactic was to wait until the whites emptied their weapons, then charge before they could reload. For close-range fighting, the whites had hatchets or tomahawks that were of limited use at best. Comanches, meanwhile, carried a far more effective and battle-tested assortment of weapons: a disc-shaped buffalo hide shield, a 14-foot plains lance, a sinew-backed bow, and a quiver of iron-tipped arrows. Their abilities with bow and arrow were legendary. In 1834, Colonel Richard Dodge, who was skeptical of the stories of their prowess, nonetheless observed that the Comanche will grasp 5 to 10 arrows in his left hand and discharge them so rapidly that the last will be on its flight before the first has touched the ground, and with such force that each would mortally wound a man at 20 to 30 yards. He also noted that, while for some reason the Indians had trouble shooting conventional targets, put a 5-cent piece in a split stick, and by giving a dexterous twist, he will make the arrow fly sideways and knock down the money almost every time. Their accuracy from the back of a moving horse was, to most white men, astonishing. The most destructive arrow wounds often came from the iron tips, basically just rough-cut triangles fashioned from barrel hoops or other sheet iron acquired from traders. They often bent or clinched when they hit bone, creating great internal damage and making extraction excruciatingly painful. The Plains Indian shields, made of thick layered hide, were surprisingly effective against bullets, and at the right angle could stop any bullet from a musket and even, later, a rifle. Their flexible lances were especially deadly. Indians used them to spear 3,000-pound buffalo from behind, always on the right side, between the last rib and the hip bone, at full gallop, which meant that they got lots of practice. They were unmatched by anything the white man had at close range, and, as Dodge observed, exceedingly destructive to life. Indians had guns, too, though their use in combat against whites prior to the advent of repeating rifles in the 1860s has been greatly overstated. Most of what the Indians had were cheap trade muskets that were inaccurate, fragile, and used inferior gunpowder that produced low muzzle velocities and often did not work in humid or rainy weather. When they broke down, which they often did, Indians could not fix them. In treaties, Indians often asked for gunsmithing services. In the eastern woodlands, where it was possible to take cover, aim carefully, and fire, such weapons were marginally more valuable. On the plains, muskets were usually fired, by the relatively few Indians who had them, in an initial volley, then immediately replaced by arrow and lance.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.